Title of our sermon this morning, called Into the Storm. Turn with me to Acts chapter 27, please. Acts chapter 27. A whole bunch of names here, but you will see some of these names on a map. And we want to point it out. If you're listening at home and you have a Bible with maps in the back, you might want to look at the map that shows Paul's missionary journeys, especially his journey to Rome. It says in Acts 27, verse 1, it was determined that we should sail into Italy. They delivered Paul and certain other prisoners unto one named Julius, a centurion of Augustus' band. And entering into a ship of Adramyttium, we launched, meaning to sail by the coasts of Asia. One Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. And the next day we touched at Sidon, and Julius courteously entreated Paul and gave him liberty to go unto his friends to refresh himself. And when we had launched from there, we sailed unto Cyprus because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed over the sea of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia. And there the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy, and he put us in it. And when we had sailed slowly many days and scarce were come over against Cnidus, the wind not allowing us, we sailed under Crete over against Salamina. And hardly passing it, came unto a place that is called the Fair Havens, near unto the city of Lasea. Now when much time was spent, and when sailing was now dangerous, because the fast was now past, Paul admonished them and said unto them, Sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and much damage, not only of the lading and ship, but also of our lives. Nevertheless, the centurion believed the master and the owner of the ship more than those things which were spoken by Paul. And because the haven was not commodious to winter in, and more part advised to depart there, if by any means they might attain unto Phoenix or Phoenix, there to winter, which is in haven of Crete, and lies toward the southwest and northwest. And when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, loosing there, they sailed close by Crete. But not long after there arose against it a tempestuous wind called Euroclydon. And the ship was caught and could not bear up into the wind, and we let her drive. We may talk about a little bit more as we go on, but that's where we're going to end our reading this morning. There are times in which you and I as human beings find ourselves headed in a direction over which we have no control. It might be a pathway which we personally would not have chosen for ourselves, yet one over which God has the oversight. There are times we must go that way because there is no choice. I think we experienced that with the fire of our building. None of us would want a building to burn down. We did not choose that, but that's the direction God chose for us. And I think that's true, and sometimes we face major problems in our family, and some children are not following, and we get so frustrated, but that's the way it's gone, and there's nothing we can do about it at the time. Illness is another example, that sometimes God chooses that path that we would not personally choose. Now, as children of God, we do all within our power to make changes, but ultimately, we leave the results with the Almighty. And from our text this morning, we wish to see this truth. Doing our best to avoid trouble, we trust in God when facing it. First of all, look at the struggle. The day had come. The Apostle Paul was to be sent to Rome. Verse 1 records what happened. And it came, it was determined that they should sail into Italy. They delivered Paul and certain other prisoners unto one named Julius, a centurion of Augustus' band. There were other prisoners, probably some of them very guilty of gross crimes. They were all going together. But remember, something that was said in the last chapter, that it said that both Festus and Agrippa were in agreement that if Paul had not appealed to Caesar, that he could have been a free man. But he wasn't. The name of the centurion responsible for Paul was Julius, and it says he was of the Augustan regiment. This man was a very important man. He belonged to a very elite group of soldiers. He was of the Praetorian Guard, the very ones that guarded Caesar himself. He was a very important man. Also accompanying Paul was another man by the name of Aristarchus, a believer from Thessalonica. Do you remember in Acts 20 when they sent people from various churches with a gift to Jerusalem? There was a group of about 8 men listed, and Aristarchus was one of those in Acts 20, verse 4. And for some reason, we later read about this man that he was a fellow prisoner of Paul. I don't know if it's at this time or sometime further down the road, but it's told in Colossians 4:10, Paul says, "My fellow prisoner, Aristarchus." Somewhere early on, maybe the first day, maybe Julius the centurion had even met Paul during his imprisonment there at Caesarea, he got to like Paul. And they sailed from Caesarea, from Judea, to Sidon, a one-day trip. And during that time, Paul had won the confidence of this Roman commander. In fact, he let him go into the city of Sidon unaccompanied. Wow. That's a pretty dangerous thing to do with some prisoners. Especially in those days, you didn't have ankle bracelets or anything like that to trace you. But Paul went to visit his friends and then came back. Launching from Sidon, now we can get that map up there. Okay, Sidon is way over here. You see Caesarea, that's where they started. Number 3 is Sidon. They went from there and they start sailing on a ship from Adramytus. It works its way to the city of Myra, up there north of Cyprus. And it says they had difficulties as they traveled, but it wasn't too bad up to that point. And at that place, they changed ships, apparently to a much larger ship, a vessel that could carry cargo and passengers. We read further down in the passage that there were 276 people on this boat. It wasn't just a dinghy. It was a very large ship in those days. Verse 6, we read about the transfer. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy. Where's Alexandria? Egypt, right. The main city of Egypt that was a port city. And the ship had come out of Egypt with a cargo of grain, of wheat, it says in the New King James, was hoping to make Rome before winter. And this served the purpose as well of Julius. He wanted to get to Rome in a hurry. And so he signed his group of prisoners as passengers to cross the great Mediterranean Sea. Mediterranean is not a small pond. not quite as big as the Atlantic, but it's a good-sized sea. But as they started out from Myra, the seas began to change and the winds became contrary. Now remember, there's no steamship in those days, right? You didn't just get on a cruise liner and say, I want to go to Portugal, and you go to Portugal. You had to go according to the winds and sail by the winds. Under ideal conditions, it could be done in a day or two up the west coast of Italy. They're at Myra, and they could go to Sinus, which is number 8 on your map up there. They could go there in a day or two. It was very, very quick on sailing sometimes if the weather was right. But verse 7 says this, it took many days. And they arrived at Sinus, and they tried to go west, and they want to go north of Crete. You see Crete there? Normally they would sail straight over the south part of Greece up there and straight to Rome, but the wind became such as it drove them south. And they ended up on the other side of Crete. Instead of the north side, they were on the south side of that island. They arrive at a town called Fair Haven. And a discussion is going to take place there, which we'll talk about. But notice something about Fair Haven. Most of us would love to go to a place called Fair Haven. But somebody suggests that perhaps it was the locals that made the name up because it wasn't a very commodious city to keep a ship in over a long period of time. It was a small community with not a lot of things for sailors to do. And compared with Phoenix, which was only about 35 miles away, it was a poor port to be in. Not a great place to spend your winter. Maybe it was like being in Tuktuk for winter. Not a place most of us would like to spend the winter. So if you look at the map, you'll see that town of Phoenix. And as I say, it's only about 35 miles away. And so it would seem that that might be a good place to go. And in the decision, Paul was permitted to have his input. Look at the suggestion. Something very important is given in this text in verse 9. Sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over. What fast is being referred to by Luke? It was the fast of the Day of Atonement. This was the only fast that I can read of, at least, that was required by law of the Old Testament believers. One day fast. We sometimes think of them fasting and fasting and fasting. It wasn't a common practice. They feasted a lot more than they fasted. And this particular day was one day in length. It was in the 7th month of the Hebrew calendar and corresponds to our late September, early October period. In the Mediterranean Sea, shipping closed entirely from the months of November until February. The winds just were imperfect and the storms were terrible. It was dangerous to even venture out on the sea during those months. So when they got to Sinus, they wanted to go west, but they ended up down south. And it says in verse 9 about Paul that he advised them. Verse 10, saying, men, I perceive this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo, but also of our lives. Now, this is not a prophecy. It isn't suggested that it was a prophecy. But for some reason, something happened that put a heavy burden upon Paul. Why would Paul even dare to comment upon this venture? There's some things to think about when it comes to Paul. You see, he was not a prairie chicken. He didn't live in the flatlands like we do. I remember hearing of some college friends of mine They both graduated before I started attending, but I got to know them. And they got married during the summer, and they went down to a place called Long Beach on Vancouver Island. Some of you may have been there. Beautiful beach. Sandy, not very warm, though, for swimming. And they went down there, and they had a brand new Japanese car. I don't know what make it was, but they went down to that beach, and they ignored the signs that said, don't drive on the beach. But they're from the interior of British Columbia. Neither of them had ever lived on the coast and so on. So they drive on the beach, and they go for a walk on this beautiful beach, enjoying it, the smells and all the rest of it. Salt water, there's something about salt water that if you've been near it and lived near it, it kind of brings back some neat feelings. But anyway, they're walking along, and on the way back, they started to notice something they hadn't even thought of because they lived inland. Guess what they started to see? The tide started to come in. And then they realized, our car is parked on that beautiful sand. They ran back, but it was too late. The water had softened the sand, and they lost a vehicle, a brand new vehicle. Saul wasn't that kind of person. Paul had been born on the seacoast. Very, very interesting. He was born in Tarsus, and he knew the sea, and particularly he knew the Mediterranean, because Tarsus, I don't think it'll show there, but you see Cilicia, number 5 up there in the map? That's where Tarsus was. So he knew the coast, and he had a lot of understanding. This was not like Jonah, who didn't understand the sea. Paul had many experiences, and probably living on the seacoast, you would hear these salty old sea captains and the merchants come in and talk about their various ventures. He knew what he was talking about. Secondly, he himself had traveled extensively on the ocean as well. One commentator suggests that he probably traveled at least 3,500 miles on the sea. He would have known a great deal about weather, sailing, and all the things associated with the maritimes. And he knew when it was wise to put away the sails for winter. Thirdly, we know from his testimony later in 2 Corinthians 11 that he had had two other failed trips where he had been shipwrecked. And one of those two times, it says in 2 Corinthians 11, 25, he spent a night and a day in the deep. That means he was drifting on some driftwood from the ship that had been torn apart. He was not keen to repeat this story. Would you? If you've ever been on the sea, you know how tempestuous that can be. I grew up as a young boy in the Bay of Fundy. The Bay of Fundy has the highest tides in the world. And you wouldn't believe what can happen on that bay sometimes. Well, Paul was much aware, but Paul had opposition to remain at Fair Haven. We need time to think and consider the wall he ran into. Look at the stubbornness. Verse 11 says, nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul. You say, why in the world would the centurion have a say? Well, I suppose he could take his prisoners and stay at the thing. But do you know he was the one that had the choice of what that ship would do? One would think the captain, or perhaps the owner, would have the final word. But that is not the case. The centurion did. Notice verse 10 said they had cargo. And it's interesting, as they neared some treacherous shoals of the sea, the men first lightened the ship in verse 18. And on the third day, they threw overboard the ship's tackle in verse 19. Later on, just before the shipwreck takes place, in verse 38, it says they threw out the grain. You need to understand this. The way Roman society and government worked was this. Food was a very precious commodity to the Romans. And the ongoing of the big city of Rome, the largest city in the world, they treated food much like we treat utilities today. The government had a lot of say on the flow of grain into the city of Rome. And because he was a centurion and a representative of the government, he had command of the ship because it was containing grain to go to Rome. Not the owner, not the captain. Now, they had a lot at stake, too. And this is why I think they pushed to keep going. Because, you see, Rome apparently paid more for grain that was brought in during the risky time of the year than they did during the summertime. And that's likely the reason they left Asia in the first place. And after they struggled to get to Sinus from Myra, and then even to go over to Crete. You see, they wanted that big payday. I wonder how many people are motivated by a big payday. I hope none of you are, at least not risking things. I know people that will stand in line at a lottery terminal for hours if they know there's a big payday coming. Well, these guys were doing that. They said, we got a chance. We got to go for it. We need that extra cash. But they weren't going to try to go to Rome. All they were going to try to do is go from number 10 to number 11. You see, that's not a very big distance, is it? Because, you see, the sailors, well, there wasn't much entertainment in the town of Fair Havens. And Phoenix was a place where there were many people and a great place for sailors to do whatever sailors do. But all they had to do was to go about 4 miles past Fair Havens. You can't quite see it in the map, but you'll notice that Crete goes suddenly north. Do you notice that on the map there? Well, there was a cape 4 miles out of Fair Haven, and it's named there Lasea. And if they could get around that and into that area where it was more sheltered, they would be fine. The rest of the sailing, they would make it. But what happened? Well, this trip that should have taken a few hours, an afternoon cruise, didn't turn out that way. One day, in verse 13, they had what they thought was a beautiful sign. The soft south wind blew in. Oh, that will take us right up, because south is going to point us right to Phoenix, right? Then suddenly, it descended upon them with great fury. They called it Euroclydon. Some texts use a different word. But no matter what, it was a furious tempest that arose. Some commentators suggest that it was a very similar storm that beset Jonah. It was sudden. It was furious. The only problem is this time that God's servant was not running from God. But God was allowing his servant to go through this terrible, terrible storm. This is vital for us to learn. There are so many people that think if bad things happen to Christians, that God is angry with them. You've heard that. You've probably been accused of that sometimes. Oh, you're sick. Maybe God's angry at you. Right? That's not what is the truth at all. Paul's in the center of God's will. He tries his best to avoid it. That's the sailing. But there he is, stuck with a whole bunch of 275 other people, bound for a journey that he would never have chosen. The disciples were on the Sea of Galilee one day. You remember that story? And Jesus pushed them in the ship because the crowd wanted to make him king, and Jesus wasn't there for that. He pushes them into the ship, sends them out in the Sea of Galilee. And what happens? Huge storm erupts on the Sea of Galilee, and they feared for their lives. You see, they were in the center of God's will, and yet they were facing some terrible things. Daniel an official, a high official in the government of the Medes and Persians, an old man at this point, has people that are jealous of him. And because of that jealousy, they go out and make laws to get Daniel into trouble. Was Daniel out of the will of God? No. He was very much in the center of the will of God. But he was thrown into the den of lions. If the lions had eaten him up, did that mean that God wasn't with him? No. In that case, God had to teach the king and all those evil men something, and so he spared Daniel. All of a sudden, in our story, the sailors realized that everything was out of control. So when, it says in verse 15, the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we just let her be driven. They were at the mercy of the elements. There is no turning back. There are four things I want us to gather today from the message we have. First of all, it is not wrong for us to do all within our own power and ability to avoid storms, storms of life. Paul used everything he knew to try to dissuade the centurion from going on the ship or even moving the ship itself. That was not wrong. But he had to leave the results with God. Secondly, and this one I want to take a couple minutes to think about. If we're unable to change what is happening, we need to commit ourselves into God's care. Perhaps the ultimate example of that is Jesus Christ himself. And I want us to look at two or three verses here. We haven't been doing a lot of looking at verses this morning, but this is powerful, powerful stuff. Matthew 26. I'll let you open to that one. The Lord Jesus Christ, in Matthew 26, is in the Garden of Gethsemane. And he is facing that terrible time that he knows in the next day he's going to be put on a cross and killed. He's gone there with his disciples, and then he takes three of them and goes a little further. He says, watch and pray. And they keep falling asleep on him. But notice what Jesus says in Matthew 26, 38 and 39. He said unto them, my soul is exceeding sorrowful even unto death. Wait here and watch with me. And he went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, O my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Notice the next phrase. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. You see, Christ knew he was heading into that ultimate storm. He knew that he was going to give his life. He said, Father, not my will, but yours be done. If there's some other way you can do it, Father, do it, but I am yielded to your will. Now go with me over a page to Matthew 27, verse 46. About the ninth hour, that would be 3 p.m, Jesus cried with a loud voice saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Some of them stood there when they heard this, said, this man calls for Elijah. Some straightway took them and ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar and put it on a reed and gave him to drink. The rest said, let it be, see if Elijah will come and save him. Jesus had lost all sense of the presence of his Father. Why was that? Because at that time, those 3 hours, particularly from noon till 3 p.m, He was suffering the eternal judgment that I deserved. And because of that, his father turned his back on him. Verse 50, Jesus, when he cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost. He had no sense of his father's presence, but he still called out to God. Even if we're at that point in our life where we have not much sense of anything and we're fearful and all the rest of it, we call out to God as his people. Go to Luke 23, which expands that last phrase a little bit. Luke 23:46. Now remember, we just said that Jesus had no sense of the presence of his Father at that time. Jesus, in verse 46, when Jesus cried out with a loud voice, he said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And having thus said, he gave up the ghost. Even though he experienced something that no believer in Jesus Christ will ever experience, that is the complete abandonment by his Father, he still calls out in faith that his Father is there, and he says, I commit myself into your hands. That is ultimately how we all need to live our lives when we get caught up in those kind of things. We're in your hands. Thirdly, we need to give glory in trial if we must go through that trial. You see, we're not here for our own purposes. When we're his children, we're here for his purpose. Fourthly, we thank God when the trial is past. Now, if that trial is that we lose our lives, we will be in the presence of God as his children, praising him so we can thank him. But if it's a trial that we have to go through and we'll come out alive, we need to be like the one leper. Remember, there were 10 men that came to Jesus one day, and they were all lepers, and he told them to go show themselves to the priest, and all 10 of them left, one came back. And that one was a Samaritan. Can you imagine the ungratefulness of the other 9 not even coming back to say thank you? Israel, the nation, had a feast. And you know something? That feast had fallen into disrepair. It was the Feast of Tabernacles. And the reason it had, they had forgotten what that feast was about. It was to remind them that they had dwelt in the wilderness for 40 years and God had delivered them, and now they were in the land. They ought to go and live in a booth or a tent or something like that for a week, just to remember and give thanks to God. Oh, that we would be a thankful people. Oh, that we would be full of praise to him all the time, all of our lives. Now, I speak mostly to believers, but we cannot claim the presence of God until we come into relationship with his Son. I heard a story, kind of a cute little story. It's supposed to be a true story, and it could well be. There were some Christian leaders that had come over to the United States from Africa, very godly people, and they were in a smaller city in the States. And one afternoon, the leaders let the pastors from these churches in Africa walk around the town. And they were all given a phone, and they were given the phone number of the person that knew the town that lived there, just in case they got mixed up and couldn't find their way back. Sure enough, phone rang. One of the pastors said, I just don't know where I am. And the pastor from the town said, well, go to the corner and put your phone down or something. Just look at the signs and tell me what signs you see. There was a pause, and he waited, and finally the man came on. He said, I'm on the corner of walk and don't walk. Many in this life are confused. They hear story after story. They hear there's this religion and that religion. They hear there's this idea of one preacher and that idea of another preacher. I remind you what Jesus said in John 14:6. He said this, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes unto the Father but by me. You see, Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the one whereby we may have life. And once we enter into that relationship with Him, once we acknowledge our need of Him, because we are sinners and we have wronged God, but when we come to Him and say, I want to love you and I want to serve you and I want to go with you, then we are His. And then when we go through those trials and difficulties that we would not choose, we can know that He is with us. My presence shall go with you, He said to His people several times in the Old and New Testament. Hebrews says, He has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Now, that book is written in Greek, and in Greek they're allowed to do something we're not allowed to do in English. In English, we're only allowed one negative in a sentence, right? But in the Greek it says, I will never, never leave you. I will never, never forsake you. Wow. Imagine that. That's the promise of God to you and to I when we place our faith in Jesus. Are we ready to commit our day to the Lord? The problems we have, the difficulties we face, if we will commit it to Him, He will see us through. Amen?